Welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners, tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service, and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, a little cool up here, but I tell you what, I'm sure it's a bit cooler down there where my guest is talking to me from. My guest today is Jenny Munro, long-time community representative and activist, for want of a better word. I don't like the term activist. It has a bit of a negative sort of a connotation on our mob. But Jenny Munro is talking to me from her tent on the block, at the Tent Embassy site on the block in Redfern. Jenny, welcome to the program. How are you?
Good, Tiger. How are you, my brother?
Very, very well. And it's great to be able to have you on the program today. I've also got, during the course of the program, an interview with Mick Mundine, the CEO, I believe, of the Aboriginal Housing Corporation there in Redfern. So we'll hear Mick's views on things. But before we get to there, tell us your mob, your country.
Wiradjuri, Tiger, come from west of the mountains here. Big country, southern half of New South Wales. My mob come from a little mission called Arambi and a town called Cara. And fondly and affectionately known by our mob as 32 Acres.
All right. And When did you find yourself in Redfern? As a relocation, as a permanent part, like a permanent move.
You mean just in my personal?
Your personal. Yeah. How did you get to Redfern? Yeah.
The big year, 1972. I was at the embassy at the beginning of the year, and I saw you swinging that baseball bat around. Remember, brother? One of the sights I'll never forget. And at the end of that year, I finished high school. No jobs in the country towns back then. Went to year 12 and got a pass. So you'd expect it to be employed anyway, but not in a country town. So Sydney was the only employment opportunity. Family was already established down here. Older brother and sister, Paul and sister, Isabel. So I came down here after you finished school and kind of got thrown into the deep end politically after being at the embassy. So I worked in all the community-based organisations here for medical service first, I think, as a bookkeeper, children's service, as a field officer first, and then the manager. I've got a test in my brain now.
So you've been around on...
It was probably... Land council, I think, after children's service. Had a stint at the legal service a couple of occasions. So the juvenile justice close to Palpa, remember we tried to set that up. Abercrombie Street, settlement, first Aboriginal chairperson there. AECG, remember the inaugural meeting at Murrawina, where other people built pretty hefty careers out of. Land council for nearly 20 years. Through that I was a part of the, my mother set up the elders, Wiradjuri elders 30 years ago, and always a part of that group. So,
you've been involved at the grassroots level, community level there for quite a long time.
Yeah.
Never to move. 1972, yeah.
And 73 was part of the group that established the Aboriginal Housing Company here after, remember the squat for the Gummies that squatted? And the medical service and legal service were in operation, so they were trying to provide services for them.
All right.
And that was where the creation of the housing company came from, that interaction of the two groups.
So in 73, all of those houses that became where people be that became homes for Kuris there, First Nations people, all of those houses, they were empties that our mob called parkies up here, called gummies.
We call them gummies. I mean, it was an affectionate term between us all, and they appreciated it and didn't. You know, I don't think our mob thought it was a
derogatory term.
Not in anyone.
Yeah, no, it wasn't a derogatory term at all. In the territory, in the centre, we have long grass people and different terms for people that virtually homeless people, I suppose. So
all parts of family too.
Exactly, that's right. And they have their own specific identity and role in community as well. Just because they're homeless doesn't mean to say they're discarded and discounted.
They're not appreciated by our mob. You know, they're still loved members of our community.
That's right. Yes, yes. Yep. And with those empty houses, that got people to come together and talk about housing.
Creating a house company, and that was like the constitution. Everything was drawn up in 72, late 72, registered. And it was just that interaction. It was, I think there was squatting in the four houses originally.
On Everly Street?
Male and females. No, it was on Lewis Street.
Okay, side. Yep.
Down towards the bottom.
Yeah.
It was just that discussion that, you know, amongst a lot of young Aboriginal people that were here in Redfern, and I'd started the process of setting up those community-based organisations, and had seen the phenomenon of how rapid the legal service system spread after the first one was set up here in Sydney, and saw that again repeated with the medical services. And, the housing company also became a model for a lot of community housing organisations around the country. So
these are the days Vanguard, for community-controlled organisations being established for probably the almost the first time. There might have been one or two prior, but proper community control.
We have the historical, the Advancement League in Melbourne that's still going, the Progressive Association in Sydney. Our people had set up like football associations and organisations for decades on local areas and things like that, and even committees for fundraisings, that's the sort of things that was done at the local level in where I grew up, and the people, all the generations that they'd had to live under those conditions, just to, try and counter it and share whatever we had, even if it was only the poverty.
Yeah, right. Yes. Now, who were some of those people, the original people? Who were some of those people at those first meetings that actually approved the constitution and then pursued the development of this organisation as far as funding, as far as acquiring the assets that are now known as the block and the housing company, housing stock or real estate, I suppose, land?
The group that was the first board of directors included, Annie Joyce
Ingram.
Uncle Dick and Annie Ebon. Lyle was on that board. I think maybe Bob Blair or Dick. Oh, no, I've already said Uncle Dick. But it was a larger board from memory, and there were certainly many other people. I was one of the original subscribers, along with my sister and other young people that were here at the time, and basically spreading ourselves across a lot of those community orgs at the time, because, they were just being created.
Jenny, how did it become the organisation that with a large housing stock? How did they get the title deeds? What was the process there, the constitution being set up and a formal organisation, but as a whole, another level?
That happened in 72. By 73, they went to see Clyde Holding, who was the minister in the Whitlam government. And they...
Was it Holding or Bryant in those days?
I'm sorry, it was Gordon Bryant.
Gordon Bryant, yes.
Getting the ministers mixed up even now. See, the years are catching up.
Well, you've seen a lot of ministers come and go, Jenny.
We certainly have. And I think Gordon was the first under Charlie, you know, when Whitlam set up DAA.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, with Charlie as a secretary, I mean. They went to see him, Gordon, and were able to convince him to provide the funds and were able to purchase, I think, two houses on the market. And these properties were held by, owned then by Kian, and is it the fellow that does Clean Up Australia? Or?
All right, yeah.
Yeah, that, he owned a lot of them. And it was a lot of derelict terraces. So they bought two and then just began the process of renovating them. The first administrator was Al Phillips. He did a very good job because he was managing the purchase, managing the... we had an Aboriginal team that were doing all the work on the repairs and renovations for the terraces and managing the housing company business too. So it was a gradual process of purchasing houses.
As they became available, was it?
Like... As they were, yeah. Mm. Because I think the purchase of the first two black houses, black property kind of, and it was already derelict slum area, basically empty derelict.
Yeah, they weren't. They weren't.
Then, yeah.
If they weren't being used as it was. So was it a case of blackfellas coming in, buying a couple of houses on the block and then, which weren't being, which didn't have residents in, they were derelict houses. But was it a case of then, well, the owners of other places thought, well, they might get in on the market here, sell up and move out?
Well, I think very much so. As they gradually bought more property along Lewis Street first, I think it all fell into place, you know, much easier. Those houses were all derelict and they wanted to get a return, the owners. It was a case of just gradual buy-up and the gradual renovation of each purchase as they acquired it up along Lewis Street first.
So the boundaries of the block are those streets, Lewis Street, then down the bottom Vine Street where the gym is, and then up Everly Street and Caroline Street. Is that correct?
That's
the block?
Historically, I mean, they've extended purchases up to basically all of Everly Street up the railway site too. So, other than the couple of little terraces down the bottom near Little Holden Street.
So we saw...
That, you know, that all probably about 5 years, I suppose, it took to buy up Lewis Street and about another five to do the Everly Street side. And that was, remember, after all, there was Richard Pacey.
Oh, yes, that's right.
And they did a very good job. Remember, we were... just the process of watching it transform in those early years was very heartening for all our people here. And the first generation of tenants that moved in and gradually occupied, you know, all of the block eventually.
And Redfern at this time, it was made up of a lot of people relocating, a lot of people coming in from country areas. Why was that? Yeah. Why was Redfern seem to be attracting blackfellas? What was the situation?
Culturally, it always had been a meeting or a gathering place. I mean, there's historical evidence all around us of the important, significant sites that our people came to and performed ceremony all around the harbour. I mean, even look at the white man's consideration of it. It's one of the most beautiful harbours in the world. Mm. And it served its purpose very well for our people back then. And you know, La Perouse is a community that existed and still exists today before Captain Cook arrived and did all that robbery and murder. Redfern also had a discreet black community and, you know, historically the Gadigal people, evidence says a great many of them are wiped out in the first 50 years just through the viciousness of the smallpox that ripped through our people in this area, you know, first contact place. So, survivors, and in that area in the 70s, you know, a lot of our people were young people coming off reserves and missions, no employment there. Sydney was certainly a beacon because there were Aboriginal people here. You could find family, you could find a bed, you could find a... it might have taken a bit of walking and a bit of time to find where they were before the block, but... you know, our people were already here and well established working in industrial areas around Alexandria, Newtown, up Surry Hills, wherever there was employment. Our people sorted out. It was the lowest jobs with the lowest wage, but it was an income to families that, you know, desperately needed it at the time. And there was an explosion of black political awareness here in the 70s, you know. The equivalent up there was the Panthers. We had a chapter of the Panthers, Black Panthers here in Sydney too. So it was, I think, Bob Mazza describes it most perfectly in Ningarana when he calls it a black renaissance.
Yeah.
You know, we were coming back finding mob, finding family. A lot of our kids that had been, our people that had been in institutions, you know, like the boys, Kintyre boys, Cootamundra girls, all come in, and Sydney was a mecca, at Redfern in particular, for them to find their mob, find family and reconnect. And after 72, when the houses went up, over that first 10-year people period, you know, we had mob coming from everywhere, right around the country all the time. And with our community, like all black communities, the houses were, the doors were open. Family and guests were welcomed and we shared everything. Yeah.
We'll listen to an interview with Mickey Mundine in a little while, but he refers to the drugs, and that was the reason why they had to move people out and pull houses down. Now, I'm quite disappointed and horrified that I believe they were perfectly good houses. Sure, they might have had plumbing issues and electrical wiring issues, but I think the foundations, those solid brick walls, they were solid structures, because there's exactly the same structures are still in place along Caroline Street and even down the bottom of Everly Street opposite the gym. There are still exactly the same structures are in place, and I believe that those houses were pulled down quite intentionally and deliberately to move people out. But that's only my personal feeling, and I'm just so I'm outraged that perfectly good houses were pulled down, and when the housing company's there to house, not to make people homeless.
Well, I think the point everyone forgets is they were tenanted by perfectly good people too. The first generation of kids that grew up here grew up safe. They were, you know, the saying that the village raises the children. You know, they were raised here by a village of people, aunties and uncles that looked after them and made sure they were safe, like all our communities are. It wasn't until that the notoriety that came to this place came under Mickey's watch. I think that's what everybody's forgetting.
That's a good point you make. That's a good point you make. It happened under Mickey's watch.
Yeah. I mean, his charter was to maintain the houses, keep them in good repair, collect the rent, and keep doing that every week. Maintain the houses, keep them in good repair, and collect the rent. He went on to bigger and better things. I think that's part of the problem here. We have a massive ego in play.
We saw Sartor. What was his name? He came along.
Frank
Sartor. He was the mayor. Wasn't he the mayor of Sydney at one time?
Yeah, he's played around with
He's been involved in politics for a long time, but he came along and was certainly caused some outrage and stuff there in the community as well, with his references to the Pemulwuy development process and stuff as well.
Well, this plan that Mickey had called Pemulwuy has been on the books for a good 10 to 15 years at least, I guess. You know, the first lot of plan restored and renovated the houses and maintained the charter of the organisation to keep them the priority. But it's the later plans and the one that's been approved in particular that have gone right away from keeping the housing and the community people's, you know, with low interest housing as the priority for the organisation. These are issues that we, you know, we're trying to come to grips with now as I speak to you. And it is ongoing. I think the ego is that massive up the road that we're talking about, that he's deluded himself into thinking that this is all a good plan. And that's another part of the problem. You really can't see, and it's obvious to anyone that's, you know, reasonably sane and got a logical brain, that this promise of housing at some ephemeral time in the future, dependent on how much money they make between him and the developer, and only half the housing that was originally here anyway, is really a betrayal of the charter of the organisation and a breach of the CEO's duties as a CEO.
Now, in recognition, I want to take a short break and then talk about, in recognition of this by people like yourselves and other interested community members, seeing that you felt there was a breach of the CEO's role and powers, the tent embassy was set up on the block. I think it was on Sorry Day. Was that the 13th of
February?
26th of May. 26th of May, right, yeah.
Was it
Sorry Day?
Yeah,
it was Sorry Day in May. That's right. Yes. Of course. Jenny, you set up the organised for the tent embassy to go up as a protest, I believe, and a statement to be made to the community, but to the housing company, Mick Mundine, as CEO.
Yep, 26th a day. We consider it to be a sorry day for all our mob that we have to make this type of statement, but it is vitally necessary in this particular instance because the development has been approved by council. The money is all there to go ahead with the turning of the soil and the date, I think, for that to happen was yesterday. Members of the community have been expressing deep concern and worry about the future for those people that had been promised housing here whenever this Pemulwuy project was completed and they got the housing built here. We've been having discussions for quite a while. Over a number of years, in fact, it was actually I couldn't do anything for quite a while because of personal family sorry business that we had to do. And even coming, as soon as coming back from down there at the foyers, and a group of women had been speaking for a while, we decided to take that action on the day that we did. And it was just too directly at the CEO and the housing company to stop this madness, this greed, this trying to turn us into something that we're not. Mickey trying to tell a community how to behave is really arrogance in the extreme, and he's been doing that for a very long time here. And it's quite ironic when you consider the history of the place and what the statement I made earlier about all of the dysfunction and the notoriety that came to this place happening under his watch. Mm. And I consider him to be directly responsible for a lot of sorrow that's happened in this community. Old people, a war of attrition was waged on all our old people here when he knocked out their toilets and wouldn't repair them. Then poor old women, if they didn't have neighbours or family close, they'd have to walk up to, railway station or further to go to the toilet. Basic amenities like that being removed from old women.
With the new plans, these new plans that he's got.
This is the old stuff that I'm talking about.
Yes.
How the notoriety came to the place and how Mickey was very much a part of bringing that bad name and that bad reputation here. The mismanagement of the assets, the houses themselves. He was the general manager. He was the CEO. It was his job to look after that. And yet he did exactly the opposite.
So with the houses...
disrepair.
With the houses being run down and tenants moved out, Mickey during this time has had... some plans done up where there's houses to be built. Now it's a long time since the houses were knocked down. It's a number of years, and it's just a bare block of land there, and which is made space for your tents and that.
Remember Arnie Joyce? I think it was a TJ when we lost that. Yeah, we lost that poor boy.
Yeah.
We went to Parliament House, left the block on the march, and when she got back, that old lady's house was all knocked down. And all the stuff out the front, she's crying in the street.
Mm.
And that's how, that was the type of treatment that this CEO meted out to respected elders in our community.
Tell us what you've got there around you at the moment. You came in on the 26th of May, put up a few tents. when you wake up in the morning like this morning and look around you, the numbers have grown. There's expected machinery to come in and start demolishing old Murrawina site and stuff, and people are prepared to sort of to stand in the way of that, to block that. But what do you see when you look around you? A number of tents, more people, growing numbers?
Yep, growing numbers. It's been very, very positive, the support, overwhelming, in fact. But on the first day, it was just we bought the ashes from the Canberra Embassy fire and lit the fire here, and then put up the one tent and said the embassy was open for business. We were here to demonstrate about the housing company and these plans to go ahead with commercial development and student accommodation.
And what was the reaction from the housing company in regards to that?
Well, I think Mickey came down during the course of what we were doing that morning. I think there's a video that's gone viral or something on YouTube showing that altercation between us Mickey's eventual retreat back up to the housing company.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't been back, in fact, since yesterday, until yesterday. And we had a few incidents here during the day.
Right.
He's also the earliest he got up for work in 7 weeks, mate, before dawn.
All right. Well, let's have a listen to the interview when I spoke to Mick a couple of weeks back when I was able to get a hold of him. And He told us about the plans to build commercial housing. He's talking about a commercial arm, building housing like open for the open market, because there's no government funds to build the houses for First Nations people. So he says there's two plans. One is housing, rehouse or housing for Aboriginal people, Koori people, and housing and commercial space for retail and stuff like that. Let's have a listen.
With the Ten Embassy being set up on the block, what's that? What's the reason for that? What's the point of that? What are they?
I think one of the articles in the paper, and you know what the media, how they write about things anyway. They're saying that the white developer, or the developer that doing all the commercial side of it, and they're saying that there's no room for the Aboriginal affordable housing on the block.
Okay.
Now, that's definitely wrong, because the block land, as you know by our constitution, is for Aboriginal and Aboriginal only. The commercial that we're building is like you've got the student accommodation, childcare, and your office all up around the top. But the block land, as you know, will always be for affordable housing for Aboriginal people. That's it.
I see.
It's just bad rumours and allegations being, you know what it's like, mate.
Are there plans to in the project to build affordable housing for Koori's on the block?
Yeah.
And is that a first priority? Is that stage one or stage two of the development? Where does it fit in?
At the present moment, Tiger, that we fighting the government, as you know, it's a new government, and fighting the government to get money to build affordable housing. Now, if we get the money up first, we'll start straight away on stage one. And as you know, like the commercial, that's stage two and three, okay, we're going to the bank for that. So we're going to start somewhere as part of our DA. See, when we got a DA approval in 2012, we're going to start the DA approval for 5 years. So this is our second year coming up now. So we're just going to make sure that, we get our priority in place. But, as you know, if we get the money through the government, we'll start the affordable housing straight away.
Where in relation to the block, then, is the proposal for the commercial development? It's not a part of the block. It's somewhere else, is it?
No. See, the commercial is not part of the block land.
Mm-hmm.
It's not part of the block land.
Where is it? What street?
You know the old Marwina site over here?
Yes, on Everly Street
all
there.
All along the railway. And then you know where the old railway the hotel? That's our office now.
Yep.
And just at the back of the vacant lot, the back of Caroline Street. This is all the commercial, the top side of the commercial.
I see,
The block land, what's going to be built on the land is the gym, the old gym. Going to be moved up the top of Caroline Street. Then we built 62 affordable housing. We built 36 three- and four-bedroom townhouses and 26 two- and three-bedroom apartment on top of the gym.
Now, that's dependent on government funds, on the government coming good with the money. The other arm of this development is your commercial arm, and you're talking to developers and banks about financial institutions about backing that.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So you may then, the housing company has the opportunity to, as governments can be very slow and the tight economic climate now, they're saying there's no money. They're saying that there's no money around. So there is a chance that there will be no money in the next year or two for the development on the block. So does that mean you're able to go ahead with your discussions with developers to kickstart the commercial arm?
See, at the present moment now, the developer already, we signed a contract with them for design and construct. They got nothing. They got no piece of the land. You know, the land, all the land that we got now is in the Aboriginal Housing Company name, as you know.
There seems to be some concerns from Koori's in Redfern area. Some concerns that if there's a deal being done with developers, then there may be a chance that the developers end up becoming the owners, the title holders of it, if the housing company can't meet repayments or meet their end of the deal. Yeah. It could all default across to the developers. Yeah. Is that a possibility?
The Aboriginal Housing Company getting a loan through the bank. Developer got nothing to do with us. The Aboriginal Housing Company getting a loan through the bank, because we class as a developer ourselves, see?
Yep.
At the present moment. And like the land, the housing company land itself, okay, the block itself, but it got the government funding. And we never put that land up a crackle, anything toward the bank. The land is still stand as it is.
All right, yeah. So then with the embassy being set up there, what's the housing company's position regarding that? Is that okay? Is it not okay? Have you clarified your position with them?
Stolen generation. And that's fine, mate. We have to be very mindful about that. But they're still here today, so we'll see what happens, mate. Look, we don't want to go and ever make a big scene with, please. That's the past. That's the past, brother. As you know that. That's the past. And I don't want to see it happen that way. So we'll just see. Maybe we'll talk later on and see what happens,
All right. Yep. All right,
and Tiger, what I'm saying, mate, I'm speaking the truth. I'm not bullshitting any like I've done. I'm speaking the truth. That's just coming straight from my heart, that's what I'm saying.
You would then understand the concern in the community where there's sort of different stories or different understandings that might not be on the mark to what the housing company's proposals are, so you understand
the
situation in the community.
All our Gouys and Murray, they listen to allegation and they get mobile and that. So that's how it is in life, But we got the plans and the DA... The DA, we extended for a five-year period. We're built within a five-year period. And the reason why we're building commercial to subsidise what we lose in affordable housing.
All right. Mick, with the houses, with the residents that were on the block and have they been relocated into other houses or they just go and find their own places? Well, what's the story with residents?
Every tenant was on the block. We got them relocated to apartment housing and affordable housing, like affordable apartment. The first were down in... another one was the first would be down what Erskineville, but they're all around Redfern and Waterloo. They've all been relocated around the area. We're close to the Avenue Organisation, medical and everything like that. So we did not move them
out too far away,
right out of the area. Yeah,
are they properties owned by the housing company or are they?
No.
All right.
No, just through the apartment housing. Until we build new ones.
Does the housing company own properties in other areas outside of the block where they've got residents or tenants?
As we still own 41 houses outside the block, you know, in a metropolitan area and country. So we still own the 41 houses. Mm-hmm. As I say, we're still surviving with the rental funding, you know. Mm. See, the government stopped their funding. We get no funding from no one, bro.
No money whatsoever.
No money whatsoever, bro.
Your administration and stuff. Your administration, your operational costs of the housing company. You're generating that money yourself from the
properties. Yeah,
bro. Mm. Yeah. IG. When did the funding stop and why? And was it a state government or federal government?
No, it was state. Remember the time when it's the year 2004. And we had Frank Sarda. You know when Frank Sarda?
Yeah, when Sarda came in.
You know that
yes.
He was Frank Sarda, right? Well, he became the Minister of Planning, then he became the Minister of Rec from Waterloo.
That's right.
Now, all the funding come to Rec and that goes to him. As you know, they're trying to crucify, take this land, and you know what they're trying to do in the part. So what he did, he stopped the funding. We're getting 77,000 from the government, state government, for administration. They stopped it in the year 2004, but.
All right.
But we're still surviving, and we still own the land, and we still own the houses. It's all under the name of the Aboriginal Housing Company Limited.
So that's the interview with Mick Mundine, CEO of the Aboriginal Housing Company, and my guest Jenny Munro is talking today about the community view and their concerns. On hearing about what is it that you're objecting to and people in the community, is it you feel that it's not a priority to build affordable housing? Do you feel it's not appropriate that a commercial arm houses be built, retail be catered for, stuff like that? What are your feelings? What do you object to, Jen?
Well, the interview really only heightens my concern in his usual fashion. He's very evasive about those questions that you asked, Tiger. And I think the crux of the issue is that he's proposing this commercial development to, in some way, pay for the housing at some time in the future. Mm. There's no interest in government. I mean, the Frank Sarda and the Redfern Waterloo Authority was part of the gentrification push, the move of the CBD after the airport. And they fell into line, I think, Mickey and the housing company, with what the government's intentions were, and that was to purge Redfern as a black community, remove the block. The plan, like I said earlier, the plans only indicate 62 houses being rebuilt here. The block that we're talking about, there are 112 lots here. I would think with the critical housing issue right across the country that we would be at least maintaining the number of houses that were here prior to their demolition by the housing company. For that matter, the other land on the Everly Street, the Railway Street side, Murrawina, and how they acquired that building is quite still something not known by the community. And what was the price of Murrawina? How much was the price? Because the last chair of Murrawina is one of the grandmothers that is camping here with me, Joan Bell, and she has no knowledge about the housing company purchasing Murrawina. The only document that she signed was one to include Murrawina in the development plans, not to purchase the building itself. So really, the acquisition of Murrawina is one critical issue. The other issue is that he's going to spend 2 years building this development, this commercial precinct. He's gone to the bank to get money to build this, and yet there's not a word about an approach to the bank about the housing. I mean, there's a number of ways that institutions can get funding, and I don't think that's been explored by the housing company in any way, shape or form. They have been quite happy to just maintain themselves for quite a long period of time, Tiger.
Is there a fear that land might be lost, like if there's agreements with banks and banks can foreclose if payments aren't met? Is there a fear
Oh, is there a threat that this land could change hands in time due to economic circumstances or what have you?
Well, there's a real fear in the community here. It's actually, you know, quite palpable. If we can't win this battle with the housing company, we will be removed.
What are you...
The treatment of our people down in Waterloo is quite horrific by the police and the authorities down there. Concerges in the public housing...
You just dropped out a bit, your volume. You.
Oh, sorry.
Yep, there you go. Good.
Yeah, the concierges in the public housing estates down here where people have to sign in and sign out. The harassment by the police is constant. The community feels that, you know, if the commercial development goes ahead, there will be no housing and we will not come back here. And that is a real fear.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fear for someone like me who was there from the beginning and saw the establishment of the housing company and the rise and the good things that were being done in those early years, for that all to be turned around by one man's greed.
Because there was a shop, it was a very functioning community, wasn't it? There was a store there down on Lewis Street, down towards the end near Vine and Lewis. There was a store.
Yep, the Black Market.
The Black Market was deadly. Yeah. It was deadly.
Yeah.
And Murrawina, the preschool centre there.
Children's Service had its offices here too at one stage. Right. You had
so it was a flourishing community with services and stuff in place.
Yeah.
What do you want to see happen? What's going to see the tent embassy or you and the people at the embassy sit back and say, good one, you know? Do people want to become involved in the decision-making processes of the housing company?
Yes.
What do you want to see happen?
Well, as you know, we had to fight a battle when Auntie George was still alive about this very issue that we discussed, the repairs and the non-maintenance. Since that time, he's actually just stacked the board and the membership with people that think the same way. We were an oppressed minority within the housing company, the membership that stood up then. And they actually purged my membership and my husband's membership and a lot of other people that tried to get them to do the repairs of the houses some 20 years ago. So the organisation, the membership's been stacked. The board is, most people in the community don't even know who the board members are and they certainly don't come from this community. The housing company was created to provide housing for our people here in Redfern. The commercial development he's talking about and the student accommodation, if that was added and turned into housing for our people, we would have a vibrant community of over 200 to 300 families living in adequate housing. He's never ever thought or contemplated that sort of a dream. But that's the dream that created the housing company in the beginning, that we have a vibrant, caring Aboriginal community that can provide for itself and cater to its own needs, that we, like most communities, you know, we live on our own land and we live by our own law and we should have the right to be able to do that without interference from all the wide agents and authorities around here. And that's the dream that was created in 1973. And unfortunately for our people in this community, Mickey's turned it into a nightmare.
Can the plans, the Pemulwuy project plans, considering that there's a considerable amount of money, I would expect, I've got no idea, I'm only guessing, $1 million or more in architectural fees.
$70 million it's going to cost. So a good percentage will go through too.
But to date, just for the design work, the plans and all that sort of stuff, that's expensive business. And it could have cost $1 million or more, I'm not too sure. But
I'd say a couple of million.
Couple of million, right, yeah. So those plans are in place. Can those plans, can progress be made with the stakeholders and parties involved now with the existing plans? Just change maybe the name, say, well, right, there's all got to be affordable housing and, yes, well, there is a need for some commercial retail outlets and stuff would be all beneficial. Can that position be reached, do you think? Or is it an option to continue on with affordable housing under the Pemulwuy project plans?
Well, not under the plans that they've had approved. I mean, that's a part of the problem. The community's been excluded mm-hmm. from the whole process. And the political reasons why they bought houses 20, 30 years ago was to remember to stop the voices that were being heard, trying to be heard here from Arnie Joyce and the rest of us about the mismanagement of the organisation back then. It's been mismanaged to the degree that there's no housing here on the block, so there's no rental income. He survived on the rental income from the 41 purchases. I think that in itself is a breach. The rental should be going back into the houses. It should have been used from a very long time ago to develop an alternative concept other than the one that they're speaking now with the developer. And they get a great deal, a great return out of it. Remember, the developer first with the construction of the development of the plans and the construction of the development precinct. So the bulk of the money will go to them and the other partner in the deal, the Sydney University.
If it comes down to demolition of further structures like Murrawina, for example?
Well, that's all that's left, basically. There's nothing on the block. It's empty other than the tents that we've got up here. And we had a very big kerfuffle when we set up about the flag, and the sovereignty never ceded slogan, which goes with the flag for the last 20 years, if anybody that's been involved in our political struggle would know and understand. But they got very upset, the Tongan staff in particular, about us defacing their flag, because the office manager's father or someone painted it. I mean, that's just the paid labour. It doesn't make that person own the flag, or Tongan people own the flag. Mm. And I think the thing that people really should remember is that flag down on the gym was not even a part of the housing company when the houses was here. That only was drawn after the houses were all demolished. So.
Yeah, and created more space.
For me, that's a sign of betrayal. Well, that's a sign of betrayal of the community here, that flag painted down there on the gym like that.
So will you call people...
It was the houses that were important, Tiger, and are still important today. And the houses in this particular project application that's been approved are on the back burner with so many ifs, buts and maybes that it really does not look like it will ever be viable. They've got a 3-year time frame to continue for this development application period. Like I've said, brother, that just heightens my concern, and it's actually given me confirmation that the embassy probably needs to stay here for 3 years at least.
So you've got people in the community and broader, like the First Nations community, particularly New South Wales, and across borders too, I imagine, across those Whitefellow borders. People are concerned, and would you say you're prepared to step in the way of any machinery that comes in and try to stop that happening?
Yeah. Yep, I think the 5 grandmothers have committed ourselves for the long haul. Unfortunately, one of them had a stroke on the first day here, so she's still in hospital, Bonnie Hickey. So we send our prayers and love to her and hope she's well and can come back with us very soon. But the 5 women we're determined to stay, and we're determined to also resolve this issue so that our community can finally have a voice in this organisation that was set up to look after our interests. Not to exclude us, not to make us bystanders in a process that we should be intimately and critically involved in. It's our future, it's our housing that they're all talking about.
It's Aboriginal land.
On Aboriginal land. And you know, we have a lot of problems trying to make white Australia understand, the authorities to understand that on black land, black law applies is a really hard message to get
for sure.
to get through.
Yes.
We put the sovereignty sign in front of the fire. We intend to continue. We are entitled to live our lives as we see fit and to demand that organisations that were created to cater for our needs get back to that core promise of what it's supposed to be doing.
All right, Jenny, it's getting close to news time.
$15.
Yeah.
No, thanks, brother.
Thank you very much for joining us today and clarifying things. You have a great day and keep up the great work.
Thanks, brother.
We'll talk to you later for more updates. Bye now.
Bye.